in the middle of a sermon series on the life of David. We've heard in recent weeks how David was taken into the court of Saul and was honored and was given status and authority and position there. And now we cut forward in time. Saul has turned against David. He's trying to take his life. And David has taken refuge in a series of caves, the cave of Adullam and then the cave of En-Gedi. And he's gathered around himself, or has found gathering around himself, a group of about 400 men initially. So this is a passage in 1 Samuel 24 that speaks into what it is to be in a cave, to be in a cave situation. And I'm sure that many of you will have known cave situations in your lives. They can come to us in different ways. They can come through redundancy. They can come through infertility. We can find ourselves in the cave of depression, the cave of failure, the cave of anxiety, the cave of bereavement. And for all of us in those situations, the question is, what do we do in that place? How do we relate to God? Is there meaning in being in a cave? Some of us find ourselves in caves of our own making. Some of us find ourselves in caves not through any making of our own at all. But the good news of being in a cave as a Christian is that God is not limited by the cave. God is all powerful, and God can do anything he likes and frequently does when we're in that place. In fact, he specializes in doing a deeper work in us when our context is so limited. And I want to look at three things that I believe David's cave experience testifies about the goodness of God and about his character. The first is that when we're in a cave, God is with us, and he loves us, and he affirms us exactly in that place. David learns in this cave that his identity is not based upon being in a court and upon the approval he might get there, nor is it based on being in a cave on the run from Saul and his men. For David, the cave is not a place to cave in on himself. It's a place to look out to God. The cave becomes David's prayer chamber to God, as it can for us. And the first way that David comes into a fuller sense of his identity in God in that place is to, in the words of Psalm 57, come under the shadow of God's wings. He comes into the presence of God just as he is, not trying to clean things up, nor turning away from God. And he says that God vindicates him. I cry out to God Most High, to God who vindicates him. God vindicates David in the cave just as he is, in terms of who he is, regardless of his situation. I don't know if you saw this week, there was a load of new social media research out about teenagers. And the research went like this, that 40% of teenagers say that they feel bad if nobody likes their selfie, and 35% say that their confidence is directly linked to the number of followers that they have online. 47% said that they wouldn't discuss bad things in their lives on social media, and that many offered only an edited version of themselves in that place. Now, we all know of the challenge of being a teenager in our contemporary society, and for the need for teenagers to discover where their identity is truly grounded in God and not in the approval of others online. But I think a question for ourselves as adults is, do we present an edited version of ourselves to others? And do we present an edited version of ourselves at times to God? We've been dedicating Ruth today and praying that she will know this intimate relationship with God, her Father. That's what he wants for each of us. And we see it imaged in C.S. Lewis's brilliant novel, Prince Caspian, where the girl Lucy experiences God's intimacy in a very particular way. It's at a moment in the novel where Aslan asks Lucy to wake up the other children and to tell them that they need to follow him. And she's afraid that the other children won't believe her because Aslan is going to be invisible. And this is what Lewis writes next. Lucy buried her head in Aslan's mane to hide from his face. But there must have been magic in his mane. She could feel lion strength going into her. Quite suddenly, she sat up. She said, "I'm sorry, Aslan. I'm ready now." "Now you are a lioness," said Aslan. "And now all Narnia will be renewed." David, like Lucy, feels utterly weak in himself. But in Psalm 57, and in so many others, he comes into the presence of God, and in Lewis's words, discovers that there's magic in God's mane. That there's just magic in being in close proximity to God. He buries himself in God's presence. David becomes a lion again, and the man by whom all Israel will be renewed. And this is what we do when we lament to God in cave situations, when we find ourselves in one. We hold our pain in the largest possible context that's available to us, which is God. There's just no better context in which to process your pain when you're in a cave than in front of God. The second thing I think that David's experience in the cave shows him is that God can fulfill our calling wherever we are. Wherever we are, whatever cave we're in. And the cave may just be in one aspect of our life. I'm aware this morning that there'll be many of you who are not in a cave, if you like, holistically at the moment. It's not like you feel I'm in a cave in the whole of my life. But perhaps there is a particular aspect of your life in which you do feel that you're in a cave. You are in one. It can often work like that. And obviously what happens when one's in a cave is that one is cut off from normal relationships, normally. In many of our cave experiences, we feel very, very alone. And in the Bible, people in caves or people in prisons, prison is another cave setting, they're frequently alone. Joseph, think of him in his cave. But David's experience shows that we don't necessarily have to be alone in our caves. Because in David's case, he can't but help gather men around him. He's called to be a leader. God's calling on him is as a leader and as a future king. And so he gathers 400 men around him. They just kind of come like that. Later they become 600. And in 1 Samuel 22, we learn this. All those who were in distress or in debt or discontented gathered around him, and he became their commander. David says in Psalm 57, "I will sing and make music. I will awaken the dawn." What is David's song? In one sense, it's to be a worshiper. It's to come into the presence of God. But in another sense, his song is his calling. It's to be a leader. That's his song. And here he finds himself with a band of men in a very, very real situation. This is a place to come out of fantasy in the cave. It's a place to face brass tacks, to face things as they really are. For David, it's about coming out of relationships based on rank and praise, as he knew at Saul's court, or the acclaim of killing Goliath, or the acclaim of defeating Israel's national enemies. And for these men who are distressed and discontented or in debt, it's about coming out of relationships based on the negative judgments of the world. We all need to come out of false relationships, relationships which define our identities wrongly. There's a writer called Leonard Halmerson, Scandinavian, who writes about the way that deep community can often be forged when we're in what he calls a liminal space. A liminal space is a space where we've left our old life behind and we're in an in-between place and we haven't yet moved fully into a certain future. We're in an in-between place, in a cave. And it's the place which is very uncomfortable to be in, but in which we can be sustained when we share it with others. This is what this writer says about deep community. He says, community, in a spiritual sense, doesn't come from manufactured celebrations or events. Attending lots of meetings won't do it. Even parties and prayer meetings won't cut it. They depend on artificial stimulants of food, drink, music, shared common space and energy. Lovely and probably necessary, but not transforming. True communities come from having walked through liminality together and coming out the other side forever different. It happens in AA groups all the time. What happens in AA groups all the time? Deep honesty between people. Owning up to our struggles and to our wounds. Exactly what we should aspire to, and we do aspire to here in our small groups, or if you're in an accountability relationship, or just a close friendship with a fellow believer. In those relationships, we're looking to come to the mouth of the cave that we're in and share our wound, our struggle with another person, a trusted another person. But AA groups do something else as well, as church does. They enable us to have a larger view of ourselves than just as creatures of addiction. Because AA groups are based on the notion of a higher power, or as they were originally set up, the Christian God. And David is a type of Jesus Christ, who speaks into these men's lives in the cave. He becomes salt and light to them. He doesn't just keep them where they are, in distress and in debt and discontented. He shows them a better way. He sees them through God's eyes. He doesn't judge them on the basis of their history. He sees them as the people that God made them to be. And in 2 Samuel 23, we learn that he turns this man from a discontented, distressed rabble into a group of mighty men. It's complete transformation. Complete transformation in them. And he does that despite the fact he's stuck in a cave, that he's had all his options removed from him. He reminds me of Nelson Mandela, who dreamt of liberation for South Africa from white apartheid rule. That was his dream. And yet he spent over 20 years of his life in prison, often in solitary confinement. And what did he do there when his calling to be the liberator of South Africa had been completely stripped away from him? What did he do? Did he cave in on himself? Did he fall into passivity and depression? Did he become bitter? No, he did the one thing that he could see to do in that situation. He established an extensive system of study for the other men in prison who he saw as his country's future leaders. The ground that he was standing on was utterly slender. But he pursued his calling on that slender ground, and he prepared the men around him for what would come. God isn't concerned in the cave just with David as an individual. He's concerned with the redemption of the nation state that David is going to go on and rule. I just had the joy on Friday, and it was a joy, of going to the cinema with my son Finn to watch War of the Planet of the Apes. And what a great movie it was. I thoroughly recommend it. It's defined as a war/biblical epic. And in it, we see a group of beleaguered apes living in a cave. And they're being hunted down by a tyrannical figure called the Colonel, who's a human being who's intent on their extermination. It's the David situation. But something different happens in the movie. The Colonel, the Saul figure, comes to the cave and he kills Caesar, the ape's family. It's as if he's killed David's men in the cave. So it's a kind of reversal of the David story in that sense. And what we watch now is the David figure, Caesar, becoming consumed with the desire to take revenge on Saul. But he doesn't. Right at the climax of the film, he makes the choice to lay down his weapon. And through that action, the figure of the colonel is defeated. And as a result of that action, Caesar the ape liberates his fellow apes from slavery and leads them into a promised land. It's David/Moses. Now, David could have turned away from God's presence when he was in this cave, but he didn't. And he could have despaired of his calling, but he didn't. And because of that, God was able to work his purposes through him. But it happened because David resisted that call to revenge that he was hearing from his men. And he didn't take up arms against Saul. Which brings me to my third point. So if the first point was number one, God is with us, loves us, and affirms us wherever we are. And number two, God can fulfill our calling wherever we are. Number three, God can manifest his glory wherever we are, whatever cave we're in. He does this in caves again and again, scripturally. Elijah, Joseph, Lazarus, Paul in prison. He comes in glory. He reverses all the power dynamics of the normal world, and something extraordinary happens. What happens when Saul comes into the cave to relieve himself? David has a kind of Garden of Gethsemane experience. Is he going to call on 12 legions of angels or on his 600 men and slaughter Saul? Or is he going to stand true to the fact that he knows that Saul is the anointed king? Can you imagine the act of self-government, self-restraint it took for David not to kill Saul at that point? Can you imagine what it was like to have 600 men at his back saying, kill him now? And to say, no, that's not the right way. And this really points to the deep work that God had done in David in that cave. God had allowed David to understand that he needed to receive his identity from God alone and not from the changing currents of men's opinions. David won the battle in prayer long before he ever won it on this battlefield outside the cave with Saul. And he won the battle of refusing to kill Saul because he'd wrestled his own feelings of revenge and bitterness to the ground in prayer and conquered them before this situation ever happened. David fights Goliath with 5 smooth stones. It's a physical battle. But now another giant comes into the cave And David has another choice, to fight Saul as a spiritual battle with words of peace. And he does that, and as a result of that, Saul is disarmed and lets David go. David puts his earthly passions to death and therefore can be raised up to new life and go on to be the anointed king. Now, in all of this, David anticipates the suffering and the persecution of Jesus himself, the suffering that he knows. But Jesus goes far beyond David in what he suffers. Jesus lost everything on earth. He didn't just lose his best friend as David does when he loses his best friend Jonathan. Jesus loses all his friends. He's not just an outcast in a cave. He's set outside the city gates and he's nailed to a cross and crucified. He doesn't just give up his security in a court, he gives up his life. And in the world's eyes, it's the most ignominious end. But as he says when he meets the two followers on the road to Emmaus, when he's risen from the dead, he says, "Did not the Christ have to suffer these things and then enter his glory?" Jesus knows that growth and transformation comes through pain and suffering. At the end of Psalm 57, David says, "Let your glory, God, be over all the earth." David is in a dark cave, but he ends up proclaiming the glory of God. And that's really a picture of the Christian life. Because the Christian picture is of us all in a cave who require liberation. We dwell in darkness, but Jesus comes bearing a great light. You remember the Chilean miners who were trapped down the mine 2,300 feet below ground in 2010. And how they were finally rescued by a mine expert who descended in a narrow borehole in a cage down to the cave below in order to get them out. Like Jesus coming down and descending into our midst. And this is what the mine expert Manuel Gonzalez said about the moment when he met those trapped men who'd been underground all that time. He said this: "I told them from that moment that I arrived that I was in charge and that I wouldn't leave until the last of them had gone. Some of them wept. I had to contain myself because I got really emotional too. That moment was very special. They made me feel that I was their savior." We're the distressed and the discontented and the in debt people. But Jesus comes to get us out of that situation and to transform us. We may literally have been like one of those discontented or in debt or distressed people. That's how some people come to faith. I had my discontents and my distresses when, as an adult, I came to faith in Christ. But it doesn't have to be like that. Some people come to faith because they simply realize they're made for a greater dimension of identity and calling than they're ever going to know from the world. And I knew something of that too. I had spiritually hungered for years. I knew there was something more. I was a mixture of both. And the amazing news of Christianity is that Jesus comes down and identifies with us in our darkness, in our cave. And then he dies for us. And then he's buried in a cave. That's his final destination in life. That's where it's all been heading, into a cave. Except that it's been heading there so that God can raise him up to new life. And where we were discontented, when we put our faith in him as that saving God, he satisfies our deepest desires. And he sees us for who we really are, and he raises us up, and he makes us mighty men and mighty women. A cave is not a box with a lid. God does his deepest work in caves. And it's where, if we'll look to him in those situations, he wants to manifest his glory. Amen.